Welcome to Voices of Experience today on KIXI AM 880. You also may be listening to it on KKNW AM 1150 or on my podcast at another time, entirely to your choosing. My name is Paul Casey, your host, and I welcome both Erics today. How are you both doing?
Doing great. How about you, Eric?
I'm doing great.
All right. We're in consensus. Hey,
I understand we even got another Eric involved with the show today, but we'll let Paul say that. One of his interviews is with an Eric, so it's like triple Eric, just so we can confuse everybody on the planet.
Absolutely.
Right. I even get confused. Yes, we do have an Eric Corgorno, and he is best known for the golf lessons he gives to more than 400,000 subscribers on YouTube, on his YouTube channel. He's actually spent nearly 20 years building a reputation as a highly respected performance golf coach. Now, he combines the art of science of golf to teach each individual student simple strategies that will improve their game. But what really got me interested in interviewing him, in addition to golf, which I need a lot of help in, but he teaches golf to teach people personal development and become successful entrepreneurs. And I kind of got what he was talking about, so I said, I got to interview this guy. And so we're going to be talking to him in just a few moments. So he's coming up. We also have Ann Berg, and she has written a book called Force of Nature, a novel of Rachel Carson. And you may remember the name Rachel Carson in history. She wrote a book called Silent Spring in 1962, and this novel really many people attribute to getting the environmental movement going in this country. So she has written a book that's directed to children. So I think that's very fascinating as well. Neil Peterson is going to be here with Meandering Musings today. Nothing we'd ever hear something like this except from Neil, and that is he's talking about date shakes. Okay? Date shakes. So you'll have to stay tuned later in the show to hear what that is all about. Voices of History today, we're going to be doing something just a little bit different. I went to ChatGPT, and I decided to look and ask them, what are the top 10 historical events in the United States? Came back with 10 of the most important historical events to whomever authored these. I think they were pretty close. And I want to talk about those 10 with both Eric Crema and Eric Ryder later. And I have one that let's put it this way. There are 10, but I thought there was one that was really missed. And I'm going to mention that. And Eric Ryder, I understand that you have one that you're going to add to it.
Yeah.
And I said you had to subtract one then because it's 10. Mm. So I had a difficult time doing that. And how about you, Eric Crema? Did you come up with one, or are you just going along with the 10?
Going along with the 10.
All right.
Fair enough.
Timeless classic for today. The author of this week's timeless classic was inspired by a famous song Bobby Gentry sang, Ode to Billy Joe. Now, again, this song inspired this author to write about what he knew, because that's what he got the message from Ode to Billy Joe by Bobby Gentry. She knew about all of the backwoods in the South and things like that. So he wanted to do the same thing, and because he was driving a truck in Georgia, and then what resulted from the song became really one of the top all-time hits of all times. Solopreneur for today. You know, when you're looking at real estate, location, location, location is something that is really stressed. And it's very true. I mean, I bought real estate over the years. I think that's the best advice I've ever had. Ultimately, if you're doing it for an investment, I say in going into business for yourself, becoming an entrepreneur, that organization, organization, organization is absolutely critical. So I'm going to go into that. So I think that's about it. If you have anything you hear about the show you'd like to call in, the phone number is 425-653-1166, 425-653-1166. Just leave your comments. So, all right, so let's get back with my interview with Eric Corgorano in just a moment.
I was on a driving range several years ago, and someone came up to me and he said, I'm just learning to play golf. Do you have any advice for me? And I kind of thought for a moment, and I said to this person, I said, the first thing you need to do is find a golf coach. Do not pick up a club until you find someone you can trust and have a good relationship with and listen to that golf coach. Second, I said, it's practice, practice, practice. And then I said, the other thing is that if you're out playing golf with other people and you make a duff shot, which will happen, and somebody comes up to you and tries to tell you what to do, don't listen to them. Go back to your coach and work things out if you're getting off your game or something like that. Do you agree with what I told this person? And what else would you have told this person if it were you?
Oh, yeah. No, I think that's perfect. It's interesting, Paul. I was writing those down as you were saying that. Getting a coach, practicing, and avoiding unsolicited advice from others. And it's interesting, you know, I'm 35 now. My whole, you know, first 20, 25 years of my life, I was definitely not a get a coach guy, right? I was very much a like, okay, let me try and dig this out of the dirt, figure it out by myself. And the older I've gotten and the more experience I have, the more I've turned into a big get a coach guy. You know, whether it be golf, business stuff, life, just fitness, health, whatever. I think getting advice from someone who does it for a living, who's an expert, who works with many other people in your same position, only is logical. Practice, right? There's an obvious one. Same thing, business, life, golf. You have to actually put time in to do the things that the coach tells you to do. You've got to go through the peaks and valleys of, okay, I did the thing. Let me assess the results. How did I do? What adjustments do I need to make next time? And then I got to go back in, do the thing again, assess results, adjust. And as you and I both know, it's just literally an endless process of that, golf, life, business, et cetera. And then the third one, you know, sort of funny or interesting that you said that, avoiding advice from other people in the driving range, which happens a lot with golf, really is the same thing as I've gotten older with life or business in general. You know, advice from friends or family who are thinking they're looking out for you, telling you the best thing, when in fact, you know, they probably most times don't have experience doing the thing you're talking about. I've gotten some really poor advice from people who really love me a lot. And that's an interesting one to navigate through. I think something over time, I also kind of like to like, listen, I like taking advice from people who are farther along than me is like a no-brainer thing, right? So you take workout advice from the people who are in shape, finance advice from people who are wealthier than you, et cetera. The tricky thing with golf specifically, it takes a lot of time coaching people to really learn how to coach them. I guess it's true for anything, but in particular with golf. Whereas like if I was looking for money advice, I might just listen to someone who's wealthier than me and assume they know what they're talking about. But to coach someone's a completely different ballgame, as you know, than to do it yourself. So long answer, but hopefully that's valuable there.
No, it certainly is. I went into business for myself about 35 years ago as an entrepreneur, and I found the very same thing, and I wrote a couple books about it called Is Self-Employment for You? But the reason I mentioned that is that I felt that when I was going into business for myself, you get a lot of bad advice from people who've never been into business for themselves. You don't listen to those people. And I made that really clear in the book. You know, they may be a great homemaker or they may have been very successful in what they've done. But I literally said, pick someone else out that has been successful in a business about 10 years ahead of you and go see them and talk to them about what they know about the business. And I said, it's really interesting, even though they may view you as future competitors, they really don't. They're very happy to give advice. That'd be the same with you. I mean, you could be a golfer like you are and tell people how to golf better, and then you could be going against them in a final round of a big golf tournament.
Totally. Love all that, Paul. Side note, I listened to some of your stuff this morning, and some of those little tip videos that you have on there from like I don't know, maybe 6 or 7 years ago, I went through and I was like, yep. Like love all of that. Love the self-employment stuff.
I also hear that you started out as a scratch golfer at the age of 15. How did you do that?
Yeah. So I grew up playing sports, right? Like baseball, basketball, football, golf. And I was, you know what I am, Paul? I'm like the guy who, I've got good eye-hand coordination. So I was good at like I can't run fast. I don't jump high. I'm not athletic in that sense. But any eye-hand coordination, throwing a ball, basketball, quoits, darts, you know, ping pong, whatever, those sort of things I'm good at. All of the sports I played growing up, you know, really things came pretty easy to me growing up with sports. But golf, you know, I remember the first time my dad brought a club home. That was my backyard, and the ball's sitting there. You know, it's not moving. I got my club in my hand. I think I'm a pretty athletic guy. And I had such a hard time hitting the ball reasonably well. I fell in love with playing really out of frustration of like, how the heck can I not hit this darn ball good? My dad used to play with his friends all the time on the weekends. And I think like a lot of us, when you're younger, you look up to your dad, you want to spend time with them. And so I just wanted to hang out with my dad on the weekends. And so him and his friends were good golfers. They'd shoot, you know, around par, 70s, good golfers. And so just, I think, out of not wanting to be embarrassed, and I was competitive when I was younger, I spent a lot of time practicing getting better just to try and fit in with him and his friends and play at their level. It started when I was probably 13-ish. So from 13 to 16, I spent a whole heck of a lot of time trying to get good at golf. So there's a lot of hard work in there, you know, some natural talent and ability. And yeah, by about 16-ish, I could play scratch. And moving forward from there, I think when we're younger too, a lot of us think we're going to be professional athletes. And then you get to a point where you play like a person or a team that is just so much better than you, and your eyes get open to like, okay, this pro athlete thing might not work out. I had that smack in the face when I was about 18, just going to college to play golf, and quickly realized that the playing on TV wasn't going to happen. I needed to pivot into coaching.
Now, you're a self-described golf coach. You are an entrepreneur and personal development enthusiast. I understand the first two, but how do you define personal development enthusiast? What do you mean by that?
I coach golf from age really 18 until about 27, Paul, and spent my first like decade really getting focused on trying to be great at the thing. And the thing for me was coaching golf. But at about 27 and coaching all day, every day out on the range, I quickly realized that, hey, I'm not going to be able to do this forever. Like, I can't sustain. I don't want to do this when I'm like 50, 60, 70 years old. I've got to make a pivot there.
But it seems to me that you're using golf as a way for personal development and things, but golf is a great way to achieve those goals. Do I have that anywhere close to right?
I think that's spot on. It's sort of, in my mind, has been a not to come off the wrong way with it, but sort of like a stepping stone, you know, for the next thing.
Let's talk about for a moment your YouTube golf lessons. I did see that you had like 10,000 visitors in like a 2-day period, which I found pretty remarkable. So how does your approach differ from others? Going back to golf, what do you think that other golf coaches do or that you look at and that you may do differently in a different approach?
Yes, that's a good question. To be a great coach, you obviously need to have great technical expertise. I think that goes without saying. Football, baseball, golf, whatever. The next layer that I've seen in really great coaches that I spent a lot of time studying is the communication aspect of things. So I could know exactly how to fix someone's swing, shot, jump shot, how they throw a football, whatever. But I need to be able to communicate that effectively with the person in front of me. You know, for me, coaching golf was always one-on-one versus football or baseball. It might be one on many. So I think the message is different. But for one-on-one, you have to say, okay, this is the technical thing this player needs to do. This is how I need to communicate it so they understand what I'm saying in the first place. And then really, really learning how to adjust your message and how you do things based on the person in front of you. You know, just like any sport, some players need a boost. They need to attaboy, bump their confidence up all the time, stroke their ego. Other people need some tough love. You got to be able to know how to push buttons per player. And so I think what makes a great golf coach, just like any other sport or any other great baseball, basketball, football coach I had growing up, was that. I remember coaches for the relationships I had with them more than the technical knowledge that they had. And I think a great, great coach is able to do both of those at the same time. So my goal with the YouTube videos, you know, whether it's on YouTube, Instagram, TikTok, whatever, is to try and take a concept that can be seemingly pretty complicated. There's a lot of moving parts in a golf swing, and try and deliver it in a really simple, easy to understand manner. Now, it's not always easy to implement, right? As you know, with any sport, advice is easy to give. The implementation is the key of it. And so what we do with our online coaching is like, hey, I'm going to give you the advice and the information for free. And then what we sell with the coaching is the implementation. how do you take what I give you and apply it? You know, what do you do first, second, third? Here are the roadblocks along the way. Here's what to expect. And to really build a community of support around those. And that's worked really, really well with golf, Paul. And that's something that I'm definitely looking to replicate in the personal development space.
And also, you have a mechanism to get back to the golfers, too. It's not just you go to your site and then you're done. It's you have questions and things. There's interaction.
Yeah, so we have an online community in there where the players, basically for their coaching, like they post their swing, and then we're able to give them feedback. Similar to what I just mentioned there, it's like, I'm sure the same way for you, Paul. Someone says, hey, can you help me with my business? You could give some stock general advice. That would probably be pretty good. But if you could like see their business and know more info and see the details, you could really, really help them out. So same thing with the golf swing. And then they post up questions along the way. We more or less try and hold their hand, you know, to the degree that we need to and respond to them every day. Yeah.
Certainly. And then you keep coming back to the word, and you've said it a few times, you're developing community where other golfers help provide support to one another, just what you're kind of talking about here. So you kind of build that up where it's not just something you're completed, but you can keep going back and having this interaction.
Yeah, I mean, we know, like, right, the repetition is the mother of all skill. I think when we give someone something to do once, that's usually not enough. Same thing with business, like with follow-up. You know, I'm sure you've talked with people about it. It's like you make the sale oftentimes on the 8th, 9th, 10th, 12th, you know, call. A lot of times you get the thing when you learn on the 10th time you see it, you know, or 10th time you try it. So we want them to have all the information they need. We want a community of people going through the same struggles and learning from each other, and be able to go back in and do it over and over. And a lot of like golf, like anything else, is once you identify the core things that you need to work on, those things don't change a lot over time. You're just like getting better and better and better at those same things. Like I know some of the things that you, in some of those tip videos I watched for years, of like being able to delegate and detaching, and like those principles don't change whether you're in year 3 or 30 of business. It's just you're improving those same skills, and it's the same stuff with the golf swing.
Well, there you go. That's Eric Cogorno. And if you'd like to visit his site, you can Google Eric Cogorno at Eric Cogorno Golf. That's all you need to do. And that would be Googling Eric Cogorno Golf. And do want to say that he talked about many things there. And again, why I was so attracted to talking to him is that he looks at golf as being a metaphor for life. And I do think there's a lot of that. And one of the things in golf, as you are as an entrepreneur, you're on your own. You know, you don't have the option of passing off a basketball to someone else to take the shot if you're having an off day. Or in baseball, you have to score more runs than the opposition to win. So it's really against yourself. You're playing against yourself, and you're trying to score less than more points. That makes it even a different, little different sport. And then like any sport, you have to practice, 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 and more. And how much concentration, and how you have to be focused. And then recovery after you make a bad shot. You can't let it carry over to your next shot. It's the same in business. It's a temperament thing. What's your temperament? And, you know, unfortunately, most golfers, I mean, again, I'm a duffer. I don't even keep score right now. I'm playing so bad, but I still like the game. But when you play with people and their temperaments, or that they throw in clubs or losing it. Now, fortunately, just a little sidebar comment, most golfers don't do that. They're very well behaved. So it's rare that you see that. But you have to concentrate for 4 hours. So I see where he's going with this. And I think I think he's going to be successful. He is already very successful. So one more time, Eric Cogorno. And again, his last name is spelled Cogorno Golf. If you don't get this, call the Voices of Experience hotline. I'll get it to you. That's 425-653-1166. All right, back with Voices of History in just a moment.
You just received some startling news. You're going to need brain surgery. But the doctor also says your prospects for total recovery are excellent. The doctor is very confident with his prognosis. He's performed hundreds of similar surgeries during his career. Who would you choose? This doctor or another doctor who's never performed this type of surgery? If the doctor who's performed similar surgeries is your choice, then experience is important to you. That's what Voices of Experience with Paul Casey is all about. People with experience in their chosen fields. Topics explored including public affairs, self-employment, travel, health and fitness, history, and adventure.
Welcome to this edition to Voices of Experience. My name is Paul Casey.
Voices of Experience is simulcast on AM 880 KIXI and 1150 AM KKNW on Wednesdays at 3 p.m. Voices of Experience is also rebroadcast on Kixie Sunday mornings at 11 a.m. Visit voicesofexperience.com and take a 5-minute self-employment quiz. The higher you score on the quiz, the higher your prospects for success. That's voicesofexperience.com.
Welcome to today's Voices of History.
The Japanese have accepted fully the surrender terms of the United Nations. This, ladies and gentlemen, is the end of the Second World War.
We are down. We copy you down, Eagle.
So, my fellow Americans, ask not what your country can do for you. Ask what you can do for your country.
All right. So introduce Voices of History for today. We're going to do a little bit different approach rather than just going over dates and talking about them, of what happened this day. I'm going to talk about the top 10 historical events that have taken place in the United States. So anyhow, let me get to that right now. And we're going to have a discussion about these events and whether you agree with these or not. Will allow the audience, again, to weigh in on this. But let me just get to it right now. This is first one, the American Revolution, 1775 to 1783, being number one most important historical event in U.S. history. Number two, the Declaration of Independence, 1776. Number three, the Civil War, 1861 to 1865. Number four, the Emancipation Proclamation, 1863. Number five, the Women's Suffrage Movement, late 19th century, early 20th century. The World Wars, 1914 to 1918, 1939 to 1945. The Civil Rights Movement, 1954 to 1968. Number eight, the assassination of President John F. Kennedy, 1963. Number nine, the September 11th attacks in 2001, and number 10, the election of Barack Obama as the first American president, 2008. So there you have it, the top 10.
First African-American president.
What did I say?
First American president.
Oh, thank you for that. Caught that. Thank you for clarifying that, because you are correct. He wasn't elected in 1776. We know that.
Right.
The election of Barack Obama as the first African-American president, 2008. So I think I have a really hard time messing with this list. I think it's very accurate. But there is one glaring one that I think should be in here. And I'll lead it off. And that would be going to the moon in 1969.
Yeah. Mm, yeah. I was just thinking that. Yeah.
Up there. And I talked to my brother Bob today, and he came up with that as well. He said, well, where's the moon? And so I said, that's exactly it. Now, as I said, I have to take one out then, because the rules are you have the top 10. And I would take the election of Barack Obama as the first African-American president. I don't like doing this, but as I say, it's my rules. I have to follow them. And I would put that as number seven, the Civil Rights Movement. And then I would change the date to 2008, that would include that, because I think that was such a corner piece kind of that occurred at the beginning of the Civil Rights Movement. They say 1954. Well, kind of that was a crowning achievement for that movement. So anyhow, that's what I thought I would do. But I think, again,
kind of a culmination.
It has to be the moon.
Yeah.
Go ahead, Eric.
I was just going to say his election was kind of a culmination,
yes,
of what had happened with the civil rights movement. And I mean, fighting for civil rights long before that, of course, too.
Of course. You're right. So you had one, Eric.
I was going to say the Great Depression, I think, is such a huge thing in American history, and I think it's still shaping politics to this day. And without it, we wouldn't have had FDR. We wouldn't have had, you know, all the things that he brought in, like Social Security, for instance. And I think all that stuff continues to reverberate through American history and politics to this day. So I think the Great Depression is a huge thing that should have been. I mean, 10 years of the country really being in bad shape, and it was likely that had it not ended, we might have seen another civil war. We could have seen, you know, the end of America, really.
Well, that's a very good point. Again, I can't argue with that. Now, you have to take one out.
Yeah, unfortunately, I would say the election of Barack Obama, because while I think that was a significant milestone, I don't think that it was the change, the marker of a change in attitude in America that many people hoped it would be. If anything, I feel like we've kind of pedaled backwards since then, unfortunately.
I think that's a very, very good point. So, yes, you played by the rules. And, you know, again, it's very hard to argue with that. But I thought, you know, what you said, and I think, again, the moon, I think that was very important. And, mm-hmm. again, you're covering it with what I did as well, and that would be the election of Barack Obama. And you for a little bit different reason there, but hard to argue with that. So, very good. So, anyhow, that's it for today. And hope you enjoyed that, because I thought it was very interesting. And when we did the lead in here, we had some of the events doing it. And one was the Eagle has landed. You heard that, landing on the moon. And then, of course, JFK's inauguration, and then his assassination in 1963. And before I conclude this, I realized that I've lived through four of these. You know, the civil rights movement from 54 on. Now, I was very young when it started, of course. I don't remember that. But certainly the assassination of Kennedy. And you both, all of us, have been, do remember the September 11th attacks. Yeah. And then again, sure. The election of Barack Obama. So, sure. Yeah. All right. So we'll moving on to the next segment in just a moment. And let's see. We're going to be talking to, I mentioned at the beginning of the show, Ann Berg. And she wrote a book about Rachel Carlson, the naturalist, marine biologist, and author of Silent Spring in 62, and defined the global climate movement. Her influence is still far-reaching. So that's just coming up in just a moment.
You have been listening to Voices of History. If you have historical events that you would like to share, call the Voices of Experience hotline at 425-653-1166. That's 425-653-1166.
So anyhow, I'm going to just let you know a little bit more about Anne. And again, I mentioned about she's an award-winning author. And in the beginning of the show, I talked about she's written a book called Face of Nature, a novel about Rachel Carlson. And she introduces Rachel's story to middle graders using free verse. And I don't know exactly what that was, but we talk about it a little bit in the interview. That she hopes this motivates young students to become scientists, environmentalists. What a great goal for her. Let's hear the interview.
Why did you want to write about Rachel Carlson? What inspired you to do so?
When I was reading about climate change and all the weather-related issues the planet was having, her name kept popping up. And of course, I knew who she was, but you know, the third or fourth time her name popped up, I was like, I don't really know anything about her except that she was the mother of the environmental movement. And then I read Silent Spring a long time ago. So I started reading about her, and she was a woman ahead of her time. And I thought it was time for us to shine a light on her again, and for kids to know about her. She was one person who made a big difference in our world.
It seems to me she's making a resurgence in the book Silent Spring. I've read about it more in the last couple of years than I have probably in the last 40 or so. She's reaching across to another generation.
I think she is. I think that she spoke her truth. People took a while to respond to it, but then they did. And then we do what we always do, is we kind of forget. We forget that we need to take care of the earth, that the earth is a gift, and that we're part of it. And it seems like just the right time to remind people, not just, you know, I it was interesting because when I read about her, I was really moved by her life. I really came to love her. But it isn't just because of what she's done. She's so much more than that. She's a role model, not just for using her voice, of course, for all of that, those things, but also for just how she overcame difficulties and tragedies in just in her normal human existence. So I think she's a real role model.
Now, she was known primarily as a science writer, but she also was a poet, and it seemed to me that's what kind of attracted you to writing this book, that aspect of it.
It's written in verse because I've been writing books in verse. The last three or four books I wrote were written in verse. I think that her poetic writing and her poetic style of writing made it easier for me because I'm not a person who's necessarily scientific minded, which is why I was starting to research climate change to see if I could educate myself a little. What I learned from her was that there really isn't a big difference. And when she gave her speech after receiving the John Burroughs Award for nature writing, she said that science's goal is to illuminate truth, to discover and illuminate truth, and that that was the same purpose of writing, of literature and fiction, that we're all really looking for the truth. And so she melded them both together. And that taught me something, because I really never thought of myself as someone who loved science or was a real outdoor nature person. And now I find that I'm inching that way. I at least have a lot more respect for the natural world.
And I'm not that familiar with a novel in verse and what that is. Could you describe what that actually is?
If you're writing a story, you need to put the setting. There has to be all stories, even novels and verse, have settings and you know the time, you know the surroundings. When you write standard way, you write sentences that tell people or acknowledge the setting. But when you write it in verse, you are absorbing the setting through the thoughts and experiences of a character, or in this case, a person, right? Rachel Carson. So for me, it's a much more seamless way to write. I'm not writing about Rachel Carson, and I'm not writing about the weather. I am experiencing whatever it is that Rachel or the character that I'm writing is experiencing. And so I feel in a much more innate way of expressing what I want to say. You write as a person would think. So the line breaks are there to pause for a moment, maybe, but to kind of emphasize the way you're thinking, because it's coming, it's like thoughts on paper is what I think of.
That clarifies some. It's very interesting. And your target audience here is children. What age span would that be?
Well, the book says, I think, believe third to seventh grade, but I think that maybe it's more maybe fifth to seventh grade or fourth to seventh grade, because Rachel had a hard life, and then I don't shy away from the tragedies in her life. And so it's really up to, it can be for middle schoolers, and depending on the child, whether they are maybe too sensitive because they're, you know, her sister dies, her father dies. So, but it's targeted for, I think, fifth grade.
Yeah, I perused the book, and the illustrations are wonderful too.
She's Sophie Black, also an award winning. She's gotten two Caldecott medals. She's an amazing person, and I was really blessed to have her do it.
So, is there anything else you would like to get across to the audience before we go?
I think Rachel had two important things to teach us. One is that one person can make a difference, which she did. And I think even more important, maybe, is that to remember that we're part of nature, and that when we take care of nature and her creatures, we are also taking care of ourselves. This is our home too, and we should try to keep it clean and respect it. So I'd like to just wake people up to the knowledge that we're part of this world. Let's take care of it.
Well, I think you've certainly done that with this book, and I appreciate you coming out with this and making a new generation of people, again, what you're doing, aware of this important part of our lives, probably the most important.
Thank you so much for having me. Thank you.
So you can Google Anne E. Berg, and that's Anne E., middle initial, Edward, it's not her middle name, but that's mine, but E. Burg, and that's B-U-R-G. That's all you really need to do, and you will find the book Force of Nature, a novel of Rachel Carson. Again, Anne E. Burg, B-U-R-G, and you'll get to that book and many others she's written, too. She's very talented, so thank you for that. We'll be back in just a moment with Solopreneur. We're going to talk about today organization, organization, organization. All right. In real estate, the motto is location, location, location. So before I get into that too much, Eric, I want to turn it over to you for a few moments to intro this segment.
Yeah, thanks so much, Paul. Solopreneur is brought to you by, of course, Voices of Experience and your host, Paul Casey. Speaking of Voices of Experience, I want everyone to go to the website, voicesofexperience.com. Learn about all the ways that Paul, through his writings and through his not only this radio show, but the other things that he has done professionally, can help you in your business. So definitely go to voicesofexperience.com. That's voicesofexperience.com. Learn about Is Self-Employment for You? Wonderful book, and the pre-flight checklist as well. And don't forget to subscribe to the podcast. You know, Paul, I've talked to so many people recently, and I can see the numbers actually on our digital dashboard that shows the growing number of people that are listening to the podcast. We often think as we sit here in studio, Paul, that we're only really talking to the greater Seattle area. Well, that's not true. We're talking to the world. You have audience all over the globe, and podcasting is becoming so popular. So go to where you love to get your podcasts and simply look for Voices of Experience. You can also go to our website, either kixi.com or 1150kknw.com, and you'll see the podcast tab and just download there and then subscribe. And thank you. Really, Paul, we should be saying thank you. Now, you're going to talk about organization, organization, organization. What do you mean by that?
Well, I believe that probably the most important ingredient for success in the long term of going into business for yourself and in life, too. I mean, you can be working for someone else. But organization is so important. And again, I had a mentor when I started out in business, the late Larry Kaufman. I thought I was organized before, but not even close. He really taught me, you know, to put all your newspaper onto one page. I won't go into those details to how he got me focused on that and how he got me focused on so many other things. But I learned from that. And I absolutely think that time is the most precious commodity when you're an entrepreneur in business. I think that really, when you're going into business, you should put your salary at $125 an hour. You should value your time. Not that you're going to be making that in the beginning, but it helps clarify what you should be doing with your hours during the day. For example, let's say you're doing a lot of repetitive functions on the computer. You're having someone upload your book or do something like that. Well, okay, if your time is worth $125 an hour, you can have someone else do that for $30 an hour. Because what should you be doing in that time? And he impressed upon me, it's selling. You're on the phone, you know, that's old-fashioned now per se, or you're, you know, talking to people, you're joining organizations and clubs, and you're the one out visible talking about your business, because no one can talk about your business as well as you. And I see people abdicate that, and they don't like to sell. And I don't say that I love to sell either, but you must do it. I mean, there's not a choice here. No matter what you enter into, if you don't make that decision to sell, you're not going to make it. So I'm submitting, there's two pieces of advice here, but organization really gets you to that point. And you will see that ultimately, the more organized you are and how you plan your business. Mm. One other quick thing is that what I looked at when I started my business, this was before COVID, I felt that really, again, being time is your most precious commodity, but also keeping your overhead low, is that I had free office space for the first 6 years of my business. And I was able to publish a newspaper and do all that and not pay for overhead. And when I look at then going back to my house and finishing off what I was doing for 10 years, not paying any rent, and not paying that every month, probably saved me $500,000 in the first 10 years of my business. That is real money when you're starting a business, but it's those things that make or break you. So organization is so critical. I do have that as my fourth question on the self-employment quiz. Are you organized? If you're not, don't go into business for yourself. I'm not strong about that. So anything, guys, any questions before we go on to the next segment?
No, the same. This really does make perfect sense. And there are so many tools out there to stay organized. You know, I realize just looking around our offices that everyone tends to work differently. What might work for someone doesn't necessarily mean it's going to work for the next person. And really, you've got to find that groove that works for you, I would imagine.
Absolutely. Yes. You know, it's like anything else. We talked about golf today, right? Mm-hmm. You look at a batting stance. I'll go to the baseball analogy here because it's been with me a lot longer. But, you know, you go to a video and I say golf or baseball, it could work as batting, is that somebody bats this way with the back way back and, you know, arms up into the air, flailing away. What I'm saying is I haven't seen two batters have the same golf swing ever. You know what I mean? Some are closer, but they're in the major leagues and they're playing. So, yes, you have to make differences in what you focus on that's comfortable for you. So that's a good point, Eric.
Yeah, sometimes I feel like I'm forcing myself into a program that just isn't right for me. It doesn't mean I'm disorganized. It's just I'd like to organize in a separate way. But the end goal should be have that plan, right? As you say, have that vision, the $125 an hour vision, and then plan for it.
That's right. That's it.
Great one. Great segment, Paul.
All right. Well, thank you. So we're going to move into our next segment today, and this is going to be Meandering Musings with Neil Peterson. Today, he's talking about date shakes.
Date shake. Have you ever had a date shake? A milkshake with up to half a cup of more of dates? Dates are caramely, complex, sweet, savory, and delightfully textured. Dates have always been special for me because of my grandmother, my very special grandmother. She always had dates waiting for me at any time of day or night. I just loved them almost as much as I loved her. She lived to be 104 and was the most important person in my life growing up by far. She would somehow find a way to take the pit out of the dates and then do something else to them. I really don't know what she did, but boy, were they good to eat. Bottom line, I could not resist the taste of my grandmother's dates. I never asked her for the recipe, and I really regret that now. I have no idea how to recreate what she did with dates. So you can see why dates have such a special meaning for me. The good news is that for 6 months of the year, I live right in the midst of date Mecca in the United States. 95% of the dates produced in the USA are produced in the Coachella Valley in Southern California. This area is 30 miles east of Palm Springs, which is 120 miles east of Los Angeles. Much of the area sits at below sea level, located just north of the Salton Sea, the largest lake in California, with irrigation water supplied by canals from the Colorado River. At the beginning of the 20th century, date palm trees were imported into the United States from North Africa and the Middle East. However, the first dates were produced some 6,500 years ago. Dates play a highly symbolic role in the Muslim, Christian, and Jewish religions. The largest producers of dates in the world are Egypt, Saudi Arabia, Iran, Algeria, and Iraq, in that order. Of the 8.5 million tons of dates produced each year, only 55,000 tons are produced in the United States. But 95% of the dates produced in the U.S. are produced in the Coachella Valley in California. Growing dates commercially requires patience and skill. A typical date palm tree takes 8 to 15 years after planting to begin to yield a commercially viable product. At that point, a date palm tree can become prolific, producing between 150 and 300 pounds of dates in a single harvest season. But getting the dates is not an easy task.
It is not an easy task indeed. And that is Neil Peterson from Meandering Musings. If you want to hear that full episode, be sure and subscribe to the Meandering Musings podcast anywhere you find your podcast. Or, of course, you can check out Neil's website, meanderingmusings.net. Paul?
All right. Thank you very much, Eric. Very interesting. And, yeah, you got to hear the rest of that because this guy's a genius in taking something that you don't think about often, and he gets out there and you go, wow, that's interesting. There's going to be one coming up, I think, at some point, and Eric, you tell me if he's done this one, about a shoe shine.
Oh, yeah.
He does. Okay.
He's yep, done that is right. coming up here in a few weeks.
All right. I want to close out or wind down the show, not close it out entirely, but about Seattle. We hear a lot about the Seattle freeze, and I'm just jumping into Chat GPT, and I want to see what they, whoever writes Chat GPT, said.
Oh, it's whether AI.
What is it? Yeah, AI. Excuse me, of course. Whether it's hard to meet people in Seattle or any city, for that matter, can greatly vary depending on the individual experiences, social circles, etc. However, like any major city, Seattle also has its challenges such as traffic, busy lifestyles, and a prevalence of technology, which can sometimes make it harder for people to connect face-to-face. Factors such as one's interests, social skills, willingness to put yourself out there, and the methods used to meet new people can greatly influence how easy or difficult it is to make connections in Seattle. Overall, while some individuals may find it challenging to meet people in Seattle, others may find it quite easy. So that's kind of what Chat GPT AI had to say. And I agree with that because I think it really has a matter of how much you put yourself out there, organizations and things like that. And I'm just wondering, and I think about it, is this an urban myth that started and it keeps get perpetuating? What do you guys think?
I'll jump in here real quick. It's been kind of my feeling that as new people move to the area, and they come from all sorts of backgrounds. The feeling you get when you go to like Dallas, and it seems like every other person's a cowboy or a cowgirl. You know, it just seems like we are this melting pot of people from all over the world. A lot of people coming in to work and things like that. But I like what you said there because what it is, you can stand off and say, okay, well they're different than me, or I'm not interested in that food or what they're doing over there, blah blah blah. But if you dive into it, then suddenly you're part of it if you just take the time.
Yeah.
So I agree.
Very good point. And Eric, I think you pointed that out. The point would be is that we have a very diverse city. So yes, you're right. You go to some cities and it's pretty much the way it is, like 70% of the population. So with all the diverse businesses we have, that is a challenge as well, but I think it's opportunity.
Yeah. People often cite, you know, the fact that in some places randos on the street will just start talking to you as opposed to here where people are maybe a little more standoffish. But I wonder how often does a rando saying good day to you on the street lead to like a meaningful friendship, or does it just, you know, you say hi and go on with your day? How often does it lead to, okay, that's your new friend once you've moved to that town and now you're hanging out and you've got a bunch of friends? I feel like this is probably a problem anywhere in the world. That's, you know, anywhere you've got a population that's bigger than, say, 50,000, you may have trouble making friends unless you go out of your way to actually get involved with different events and activities that would lead you to lasting friendships and relationships.
Now, interestingly, I have a very good friend who grew up in the Midwest and came out here for about 5 years, and he couldn't get over how open people are here to tell you about themselves and quickly. He goes, this never happens in the Midwest, at least where I live, where you might go to a bar or a restaurant and just start chatting with a server, let's say. And that server, by the time he's done with his meal, he knows that they're divorced, you know, a couple of kids, they've had some issues here, or their dream is to do this. He goes, people in the Midwest don't open up like that, like they do here. And I found that interesting.
Yeah, too much information, maybe. Could be the opposite. Right. You know, let's ask the audience if you have what your experience. Have you just moved here to Seattle or you've been here a long time? The Seattle Freeze. What's your experience been? 425-653-1166. We'll get it on the air either next week or the following weeks. 425-653-1166. Thank you again for that. Hey, Eric, how much time do we have?
Well, we've got about a couple minutes here to close.
Oh, good. All right, let's do that now. We're coming up on the Timeless Classic, and I'm glad to put that on today. So I just want to let you know that Voices of Experience airs on Kixi at 3 p.m., as you know, and on KKNW, 3 p.m., and of course, have the podcast, and you can certainly listen to that. And just Google Voices of Experience. It's up in the high now that in the charts that you can see Voices of Experience, and just you can hear every episode. Couple things coming up. The Moisture Festival starts tomorrow, March 21st, runs through April 14th. Put that on your calendar, and it's going to be at the Broadway Performance Hall next to Seattle Central College, and that's on Broadway in East Pine, Capitol Hill. Couple topics coming up for the next couple of weeks. I have Michael Bergen coming up, Weird But True. It's another book developed and written for children, and it's about the U.S. government. I think that's going to be interesting. And Joe Yogerst, who I've had on the show several times, is going to talk about 50 states and 1,000 places to eat in those states. So this would be the ultimate road trip if you want to do something like that. But he's going to be talking with us coming up in a couple weeks. Quote of the week, tell me and I forget. Teach me and I remember. Involve me and I learn. Benjamin Franklin. Have a great rest of the week, everybody.
This week's Timeless Classic was written by Tony Joe White in 1967, but it didn't become a hit until 1970. Tony said, "The Ode to Billy Joe, sung by Bobby Gentry, inspired him to write a song about something he knew about. He drove a dump truck for the highway department, but when it rained, he didn't have to work, and he could stay up all night playing his guitar and writing songs. So he knew something about the rain working in Marietta, Georgia, and he wrote about it. This song is considered the 498th best song of all time, according to Rolling Stone magazine. From 1970, Brooke Benton and Rainy Night in Georgia.
Hoovering by my suitcase, trying to find a warm place to spend the night. Seems I hear your voice calling, it's all right. A rainy night in Georgia. A rainy night in Georgia. It seems like it's raining all over the world. I feel like it's raining all over the world. Neon signs are flashing, taxi cabs and buses passing through the night. A distant moaning of a train seems to play a sad refrain to the night. Georgia, such a rainy night in Georgia. Lord, I believe it's raining all over the world. I feel like it's raining all over the world. How how many times I wondered. It still comes out the same, no matter how you look at it or think of it.